Hello, everybody. Jeff Salzman here, and welcome to the Integral Living Room Community Call. It's really good to feel everybody on this call from north and south and east and west as we, you know, seek to knit a new view together that can carry us into a better future. For those of you who are new to the community, we do these calls every 3 or 4 months as we prepare for a live gathering that we do every year here in Boulder, Colorado at the Integral Center. And we've been doing these for 5 years now. This coming event is in November 9th through 12th. It's a Thursday night through a Sunday noon. There are still places available if you're interested. And you can find out more about it at integrallivingroom.com. The topic for this year's Integral Living Room, where we have the best conversations of our lives, that's our tagline, and we do it. The topic this year is A Shout from the Heart, Living an Integral Activism. And I think this is our third call. In the first call, we talked to Ken Wilber, who, you know, gave us insights into how activism fits into the integral map and, you know, basically focused on education. And you know, bringing the integral worldview online as a form of activism. And then we were just talking a minute ago offline here about how the second call was, you know, it feels like every conversation is mandated we have to talk about Trump. So we just dedicated a whole call to, you know, what's an integral response, even as opposed to a green liberal postmodern response. What's the response to Trump? And that's more of an inquiry than an answer, but, you know, it's what people want to talk about. And so we did that last time. And both of those calls, by the way, are available on the website on tape. So if you want to go listen to them, please do. They're really, I think, we loved them. They were very rich. And tonight we have really a very special agenda planned as we bring in some voices of some of the seasoned activists in our own integral community who are here with us live. So at this point now, I will introduce my co-hosts, Terry Patton. Hey, Terry, how are you doing tonight?
It's really good to be with you and everybody here. Thanks, Jeff.
You bet.
I'm kind of brokenhearted. I just suffered a very dear and near death, and I'm in kind of mourning, but I'm not so deeply in mourning that I can't appreciate the richness of our coming together, and I'm here.
Well, your broken heart is welcome here. And our my other co-host is Diane Hamilton, and Terry and Diane and I do this event together. So, Di, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine, and I'm really happy to be on the call with you, Jeff and Terry. And I'm in Utah. I'm in Salt Lake City, but I've been down in southern Utah where I have a retreat center and enjoying the canyonlands, just enjoying the big outdoors. So I'm really happy to be on the call, too, tonight.
Great. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're doing tonight and introduce our guests, Di?
Yeah, I'd love to. So welcome to the call, everybody. So as Jeff mentioned, this is our third community call, and the event, of course, is in November. And this year was really determined, as Jeff mentioned, to a large degree by the fact that Trump was elected the night before we had the Integral Living Room in November. So a lot of what we experienced last year was related to the politics and to our different views and how people thought we should be involved.
That's
or
right,
not be
Di.
Involved.
Yeah,
go ahead.
We won on Tuesday, and
yeah.
We started on Thursday.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Or wasn't it the same day? Didn't he get elected the night before we started? Anyway.
Well, it was close enough. It was Tuesday to Thursday, yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and
go
so,
on. I'm sorry.
Well, no. That's the whole point, is that the election and the impact of the election, both in terms of our very real preferences, most of us for Hillary Clinton, and then also some attempts to try to see the wisdom of both sides, and then also the resist voice. So the complexity for a lot of people of actually trying to be true to our own values and at the same time trying to somehow include the other side, which is not an easy thing to do. So anyway, from that, this whole conversation about integral activism evolved. And the question that we've been posing is really, you know, in our theory, we talk about, or Ken talks about, of course, or other integral theorists, I suppose, that, you know, for something to, you know, something becomes real, you might say, when it exists in what we talk about as all four quadrants. So it's real in our interior, and it's also real in the exterior. And there's kind of an implicit understanding, which is that a full life involves action. It involves manifestation. It involves being a part of the world. And there are many, you know, infinite ways to be involved in the world. But basically, how is it that we take what we realize in the interior and manifest it in the exterior to the extent that we have insight, that we see the world as interrelated, that we understand the preciousness of this life, that compassion is a part of who we are? How do we actually manifest those values and those perceptions in the world? So that's been a real theme, and it's been provoked a lot by this election. And so for this call, I'm gonna actually wait to introduce our four activist guests tonight, because I'd like to hear from you, Jeff and Terry, just a little bit about integral activism from your perspective in terms of just creating a context for the call, and then we'll transition to talking with some of our real activist guests. But Jeff,
cool.
How
Terry,
about you?
You want to start? Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll start. I'll just share a little bit about how activism is manifesting in me, and I'm kind of with Ken on this, and that what I do is I help educate people on what I see as the next more good, true, and beautiful era of human history that is dawning. And, you know, if integral theory is right, then the integral era is inevitable. It's, you know, like all stage transitions, at some point people get bored with what they've just installed. You know, traditionalism, we get civilized. That's what the great myths deliver to us, an order and propriety kind of thing. But once we're civilized, we want to get rational. And once we get rational, we want to get sensitive. And, you know, what integral tells us is, you know, and I hold it lightly, but I think, you know, so far so good, that the integral era is what happens when people get tired of looking at the world through a single lens. And we want to just get bigger. And that's just so exciting to me. It's exciting to me in my own personal life. And it's exciting to me to transmit it as best I can to everybody, you know, in an appropriate way. You know, I very much take to heart the teachings I got from Trungpa Rinpoche here in Boulder about being conscious not to aggress on other people's states of consciousness and stages of consciousness, and that we are more than anything called to love each other just the way we are, and that there is an erotic, there's a growth, there's a procreate urge that is built into the cosmos that will take care of everybody's growth. So we're not out to fix anybody or you know, change anything in a way, just to love it. I often think of the mascot for me of this is a grandparent. And a grandparent just wants to love and teach and is pretty indiscriminate, pretty big in terms of the love. And, you know, that is what I do. So, you know, in the era of Trump, I have to start every morning by reminding myself that I have to take Donald Trump seriously. And that's my first, like, hour You know, it's not easy. But, you know, I just, I go through life being more curious than critical, particularly with the people I'm talking to, like my TV guy who was here yesterday, who's a big Trump supporter, and just really fascinated by where he's coming from and not trying to fix or change anything. And he was loving it, loving being heard. And I love that. And I love doing it on my, you know, way more formally on my podcast. And so I want to, you know, give us two cheers for, you know, considering that just thinking integral thoughts and having integral conversations is its own kind of activism. Because I love what Ken talks about, you know, thoughts are things. And every thought we have gets laid down in the, you know, cosmic grooves. So something like that. So that's what lights me up. And I'll stop there. Terry?
All right. Awesome. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, you know, integral activism is a real koan because they're really, you know, a truly integral disposition recognizes the fact that there really is no problem and never could be. No dilemma, no problem. That release from the subject-object seeking anxiety-based orientation to life is kind of the foundation of the whole view. And there's this embrace of this dualistic world in which there's all kinds of messes that are urgent. And it seems as though we're in the process of an earthquake almost, a tipping point. And there's so much that is fragmenting, so many ways in which there's disintegration and fragmentation and incoherence, and wholeness is not just a prior and a principle, it's a dynamic force, so that as things fall apart, they also come together. Wounds heal, illnesses we get better from. There's a force of wholeness that reasserts itself in the midst of fragmentation. And so many of us feel that rising up in us as a urge to help bring wholeness forward. And even though we can see and trust that the life process is, you know, if it is happening, there is a sense in which it has to be okay, there's a way that that great okayness is coming forward through our dedicated service and our commitment to be the hands and feet and mouths and, you know, agents of that wholeness in action. And, you know, we do that in the system by being participants in the political system itself, against the system through protest. And we go around the system through all these creative kinds of projects that I think we're going to be hearing about now. Some of them are engaging the system or opposing it too, but mostly they're amazing metasystemic workarounds that allow wholeness to flow across boundaries that it otherwise would be stopped by. So I feel a lot of excitement that we have these four friends and guests on this call, and that we're going to hear about the doing of being in wholeness in action. And yeah, that's all I want to say right now. Thanks.
Hey, Terry. Well, those are, you know, Terry's big vision of basically a form of love in the world that experiences perfection at the heart of all things, and yet knows at the same time we're a work in progress, and somehow finds the way to inhabit that. And then, you know, Jeff talking about basically just being, you know, both really open to enacting theory, teaching theory, talking about it, but also taking on more perspectives himself and seeing what comes from a willingness to actually inhabit bigger views. What happens if I take on more points of view rather than fewer points of view? And just feeling really excited about that. So we're going to move from basically love and transcendence and compassion into talking about what's happening on the ground. And we have four really wonderful guests with us tonight. We have Gail Hachatska, who a lot of you know. She works in climate change, and she's the co-founder of Integral Without Borders. She's been a major voice in our community in terms of being engaged in the world and really manifesting her love in relationship to real problems, particularly related to international development. And Julian Gonzalez, who studies Zen with me and who is really inspiring in terms of, you know, he used to be a mountain guide and a climber, and he is now working with governments and First Nations in Canada to assist them in really big problems like climate change adaptation, transportation, health, economic development. And you're going to really enjoy talking with Julian tonight. He has a lot of passion and beauty. Lisa Gibson, who's also, interestingly enough, this whole panel is from basically Canada, BC, mostly Vancouver. So we thought that was interesting. So just a little symbolic wave of the Canadian flag. Okay, so Lisa Gibson, another great friend, and she practices Zen and also is a yogi, and she has spent 20 years in local and also international community engagement, social innovation, and social justice work. She is passionate about collaboration, conversations about diversity and difference, and about creating a world that's just simply more free and happy. And then finally, Trent Berry, who's another good friend, a yogi, practices Zen and meditation. And he has a very diverse background in economics, planning, management, and environmental sciences. Most of his career he spent advocating and advising on policies and infrastructure to increase renewable and low-carbon energy. So he's very involved in the energy conversation, everybody, and you're really going to enjoy getting to know Trent. So I should have maybe paused and let you say hi after I introduced you. So, Gail, do you want to say hi? We're going
to... Oh, hi, everyone. Yeah, no problem. Wonderful to be here. Hello.
So good to have you here, Gail. And, Helene, do you want to say
hi? Yeah, hi, everybody. I'm very happy to be on the call. Looking forward to the conversation.
And Lisa Gibson, do you want to say hello?
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm also excited to see where the conversation goes and to be with you all.
And finally, from Trent Berry. Do you want to say hi, Trent?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Really pleased to be here, and I feel like I'm riding on the coattails of my fellow Vancouverites, Gail and Julian and Lisa, who are also very good friends. So it's kind of a fun.
It's going to be awesome listening to you guys. So we're going to just start with a simple structure, and I'll give each person about 5 minutes to talk about what they're up to and inspire you why having an integral framework for activism is so important. And then we will have some conversation and crosstalk and then hopefully have time for some of your questions. So Gail, let's start with Gail. So, you know, those of you who know Gail, I mean, she taught at JFK, and she's, as I say, she's been one of the early integral innovators with Integral Without Borders and her work in international development. And it's really wonderful to have you here, Gail. So first question for you is just basically, what are you up to?
Yeah, thank you. What am I up to? Well, I just got back from Guatemala a day and a half ago, and as you were saying, I've mainly been working in international development for quite a few years now, but this year kind of focused that a little bit more specifically into climate change work, so climate change adaptation in particular, and I'm part of a research team that's looking at how we can reframe climate change adaptation as a process of deliberate transformation. And, you know, integral theory is directly in this research project's design, and some, you know, different researchers are using it to less or more extent. I mean, I'm probably the one most familiar with integral theory, so I'm using it quite centrally. And it's really, for me, it's been really a fascinating time to dive into a very, very particular set of conversations taking place about climate change, because international development is just so vast and broad that it includes so much. But as a result, mm-hmm. as a result, you can't really go deep into any one, right? Because you're kind of attending to several. Mm-hmm. But with climate change adaptation, I'm learning this really rich discourse that's there, and because it's such
awesome.
A wicked problem. Yeah, and because it's such a wicked problem, it's mm-hmm. it's really reframing, you know, how we even conceive of approaching it as a problem. It's not your usual garden variety environmental problem. It's not the local pollution of a nearby river, let's say. This is mm-hmm. so non-local. There's a lot of talk in the discourse mm-hmm. about creating the cognitive space to even begin mm-hmm. to conceive of what it is, let alone how we might
wow.
address it. So yeah, so I'm really, you know, on the one hand, I feel ready for what's coming, and I also feel like I'm really on the threshold of something. I literally just jumped into this project quite recently. In Guatemala, I was beginning to set up some of the research with a coffee value chain, and we're going to be, you know, trying to unite a number of fascinating perspectives into this, where we're looking at adaptation through a global value chain from, you know, with producers straight through to consumers and everybody in between. Mm-hmm. And bringing together, it was kind of interesting because what I'd like to do is create what I'm calling a collective impact lab. And my first, I literally land on the ground in Guatemala City the next morning at like 8 o'clock a.m. I'm so tired. I'm at a breakfast meeting and with some of the key players in Guatemala City. And they're saying to me, we need a table where we can bring together all these perspectives on the matter and actually work together. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, this couldn't be more perfect. So...
Oh my gosh.
So yeah,
that's so awesome.
That's a bit of what I'm beginning to embark on. I wouldn't say I'm totally in it yet. Because it is fairly new, but it's pretty exciting, and it's brought me to go deeper into the dynamics, particularly of how culture changes and how mm-hmm. systems change at the scales that we're going to need for a problem set as big as climate change.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say to each other on this. I will say this, that I kind of lit up when you talked about, would you mind repeating it for our audience, when you talked about climate change as a transformational process? Can you?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, climate change, yeah. So climate change adaptation is, you know, sort of, there's various ways to kind of approach it, and one way is actually quite technical. It's like, what do we need to do in the system so that we can manage the change that's happening? And it usually looks mm-hmm. like technologies or different sorts of, you know, biological or technological ways to approach it. What we're doing is, you know, the word transformation is throughout the climate change literature, but it's almost mm-hmm. being used so much, it's almost a little bit vague, and what people mean is quite varied. What our team is meaning is a deliberate, yeah, what our team is meaning is quite a deliberate transformation, is like a conscious one where we're actually, you know, being drawn into a process where we're like, wow, this is what's on our doorstep. How can we consciously mm-hmm. and deliberately seek mm-hmm. a transformative pathway through this? And so that's our basically the research. So I'm working in Guatemala and in the States and Canada. My other colleagues, some are in Burundi, one's in Burundi, one is in the Arctic. There's a couple based in certain urban locations. So we're kind of spread all over and looking at this from various perspectives.
Wow.
So
you know, it's interesting that you say that, Gail, and what I'd like to do is transition to hearing from Julian on this too, because I'll be interested to hear what the two of you have to say to each other. But Jeff and Terry and I have talked about, you know, one of the things that we did, of course, is that we, for a period of 10 years, more or less, that we did these, you know, integral seminars, transformational seminars. And mm-hmm. inevitably, there was crisis. Now, you know, granted, these are low-stakes crises in some cases, but in other cases, they're higher stakes. But it's like, you know, what was our basic set of assumptions for in a seminar context for working with what came up? And why is it we're not carrying those same assumptions, or why is it that we are carrying those same assumptions into the challenges that we face in the world? Like, so that the way that you're talking about that's very interesting to me, just on the level of discourse, is how we talk about it to some degree is going to shape our experience of it. And so I love that you're actually looking at the actual discourse and the way in which the whole thing's being framed. I mean, it's really, really mm-hmm. fascinating. So let's transition and hear from Julian, who's a good friend of yours and who also is working on big problems like climate change adaptation and other systemic kinds of issues. So, Julian, I'm just curious. Tell us what you're up to, and if you want to bridge a little bit to what Gail was talking about, you know, let's start making some linkages.
Maybe the way I can bridge is just it's interesting, and from a framing perspective, it's like my work a number of years ago was in climate change mitigation, and in the recent last 3 years, my work has changed to adaptation. So for you, for the people who are not familiar with the difference of those two terms in climate change, is one, mitigation is when we're trying to avoid climate change and do changes in the way that we as society function, so we're not basically putting so much carbon in the air and other green house gases. And I think there's something that has happened where, given the scale of the issue, and Gail talked about that, how it's non-local, I think a lot of the frustration because of our inability to affect change at a global scale, what is happening is a lot of regions are, and so the work that I do in Canada and Latin America is climate change adaptation. How do we, it's interesting, in Canada I'm looking at how to adapt for sea level rise, so too much water in many communities, and in Latin America I'm working in how to adapt to less water. So lots of communities are seeing less water in their, I guess that's just, it's interesting as we're moving into the, now moving at climate change is becoming each time more of a reality for people's, in people's consciousness, in the literature, in the newspaper, and the events we're seeing more and more often. Mm-hmm. Still is this radical, non-local problem that I think this idea of transformation, of how, what does it take for us to address this problem? I think that's just such an interesting core and an inquiry, because the issue of scale, I think this is where, if I bring my critical mind of integral theory, that's where I think Ken has not provided much input is on these in the lower right, is how do we address scale? How do we address, what is the right scale to be tackling these problems at, and how can we be better informed of how does governance cross scale, and what is the scale? Like, I work at a regional and municipal scale, but once you get to provincial and federal, that the whole conversation changes, and sometimes they're in disparity with each other.
Yeah,
and then the next question is, what does the global scale look like? U.S. pulling out of the Paris Agreement, but China staying on. So it's just, I think it's just climate change. So that's, I think, what Gail was saying. It's just such an interesting problem that way, challenge that we face.
Well, I think one of the things that you're pointing to, and I think it's kind of interesting, so, you know, Julian's talking about the non-local nature of climate change, the way in which it actually asks our perspective to shift, because it's not a river. It's actually the entire atmosphere of the globe, that our perspective naturally has to get bigger. And, you know, how do we actually begin to try to deal with the problem on that scale? Well, we certainly have to change the level at which we're thinking, for sure. And then also, I think the way in which climate change is a nice disruptor to nationalism, in the sense that the boundaries that we sometimes are used to working with don't apply. So, you know, even though the U.S. pulls out of the Paris Accord agreement, they can't really, at least for 3 years, and there's so many cities and states that are continuing to participate and private enterprise. So it's interesting the way in which it kind of does something to the nation state. And these koans, these challenges, these difficulties are something that we're all in together. And I'm hoping that through our conversation we can suggest some ways of seeing that maybe you can bring to the work that you have, that you're doing where you are. So thank you so much, Julian. It's great to hear your voice, and I always appreciate your energy. You always stimulate my thinking a lot. So let's go to Lisa now. So Lisa is also in Vancouver. And
hi.
Lisa has been hi. So Lisa, go ahead. Just why don't you fill us in? What are you working on? Lisa Gibson, everybody.
Yeah, sure. So what I, you know, just in terms of
you know, connecting to what both Gail and Julianne were saying. So I work in a different, in different areas. I'm not working on climate change, but I'm working on, you know, resiliency, and I'm working on a lot more social justice issues. But I think that we are, there's a way that the kind of the complexity of issues are, is also really similar to climate change. And so there's a way in which I feel like there's this, you know, I'm working more with, you know, with the people and with the complexity of issues, that show up in terms of, the opioid crisis, for example, or, you know, resiliency at the local neighborhood level. I work with sex workers and do lots of work around culture change and policy change at multiple scales. And there's, you know, we're in a time where a lot of these conversations are, I think, really, they're really polarizing. We're like, Canada's like working towards, you know, the legalization of marijuana is like right around the corner, and like soon, it you know, we're not far off from like radically transforming the whole way that that drugs are you know, legalized in this country. And that's true, but you know, so there's in multiple ways where there's the, we're seeing that what the policies, the culture is not able to respond to the level of the fentanyl crisis. And I think that's across North America, like in a particular neighborhood of Vancouver. It's horrendous. The number, I think there's been something like 900 deaths in the last 2 years, you know, and in a small area. And so, and it's really affecting not just people who are poor, but across the spectrum. So I think there's, in a lot of the conversations that I'm involved in, it's like people don't know, policymakers don't know how to respond, but there's like a sense of, okay, what we're doing isn't working. And so I think the conversations or the more perspectives, the more points of view, that the more inclusive and big conversations, not about necessarily always agreeing, but actually being able to hold those broader perspectives is becoming more and more critical. I'm just thinking of, so I do a lot of the work that I'm engaged in around sex work is connected to the missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so we had many women, Indigenous women who went missing, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous in Vancouver's downtown east side. But there's now a national inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women. And there's hundreds of women that have gone missing over the last few decades. But they, even the commission itself can't find a way to move forward. And one of the commissioners just stepped down. And so there's a sense that it's almost impossible to even hold this inquiry, you know? And so, you know, from the outside, I think it, what I see is like, there's these big problems, but often at the end of the day, they come down to, you know, relationships and our ability to really collaborate and be with each other in different ways. And so I think you know, there's a way that it's actually grounding these vast, you know, big social and environmental issues in also in like the moment to moment in what I can do and how I can relate and interact differently with the folks that I'm working with.
Yeah. Okay.
So those are a few thoughts.
Yeah. There's a lot in what you said. So I just want to kind of point out a little bit in terms of identifying kind of the long non-local nature of problems and also scale, how large things are, how complex. Lisa is the first one to use the word polarized, but I think we can all agree that there's a lot of polarization going on right now. And the whole question around what you talked about is even the attempts at people at response are kind of not working. And, you know, what do we do with that when things actually, the attempts people make to work on an issue don't actually have impact? You talked about inclusivity in relationship. And I think it's a question that we're going to want to ask ourselves, which is, because I think it's true in the activism community that as pluralistic values come online and relationship and subjectivity and those kinds of things become important, sometimes those processes can get bogged down and it's very hard to get effective action. Maybe we can circle back to that, Lisa, and talk about that a little bit from your perspective, if you're open to that.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, great. So Trent, last but certainly not least. Hi. So Trenton Energy, he's also an artist, a yogi, a meditator. So tell us what's happening in your world with energy right now, Trent.
Well, I wanted to start with saying I feel I'm suffering from, as a consultant, I often have the imposter syndrome. And following Lisa, Julian, and Gail, I thought, how did I get on this panel? But
it's because I'm here, Trent.
Yeah.
it's my own
self-doubt around activism. Yeah, I really appreciate the inquiry, and I was thinking to relate it to back to Julian and Gail, I work a little bit more on climate change mitigation, and but it does kind of morph into adaptation. And I think we're in this in-between world where we actually have to do both, because it's inevitable, but we can slow it and reduce the magnitude. And the reality is that we have to adapt. And I think up until a few years ago, we were in the mitigation only mode, and some people are now complacent, thinking adaptation only. I actually think we have to be moving both forward.
Okay, good to know.
And what I want to say,
yeah, Trent, just to build. Oh, sorry, Trent. I was just going to just echo that we say that adaptation, that mitigation is the best adaptation in a way. Like, so, in a way, they're the same trajectory. Just to kind of agree with you on that point.
Thanks, Gail.
Mitigation is the best adaptation. Go ahead.
I wanted to bring one thing online. I resonate a bit with Terry. Some of us here are very heartbroken. A local spiritual teacher, Michael Stone, died this weekend. And
the reason
I wanted to bring him into this conversation is
that he
wrote a lot about practice and activism. And this week, it's really affected me. I really admired his teachings, and I resonated because he came from a yogic and Buddhist tradition. But what I wanted to bring online is he said in activism he felt that there were three big issues that kind of distilled everything. His first was climate change. Climate change is kind of a symptom of so many underlying issues, and it brings in social inequality because it's going to disproportionately impact poor areas of the world. Economic inequality or social justice and the atrophy of intimacy. Those were his three big issues. And so I thought about it because really I'm focused on the climate change externally, but I think this atrophy of intimacy is also partly related to that. He's talking about the loss of intimacy with our bodies, with relationships, and with communities. And to me, that also comes online with climate change, because a lot of what I do is kind of navigate multiple scales. And it's something that isn't, I feel, it's probably the weakest kind of area talked about in an integral world, is the scaling problem, which, and it's interesting that it's come up in our conversation. Because I've worked really at the high level.
Yep.
Like legislative change at provincial, state, federal levels, and changing systems at that level, and then working from the ground up, like individual building design. And one of my kind of juicy and also struggling things is right action. Like, what is the appropriate scale for right action? So many people mean well, but it's not going to achieve the scale that we require for climate mitigation or adaptation. We've really got to scale it up. And so that's a really open, active inquiry from the right now.
Beautiful, Trent. So
can I jump in there? So
Pet P,
we were talking a few weeks ago, this notion that I just to build on what Trent was saying, to make it a bit less abstract, the notion that a lot of people are focusing on, how can I make my home more climate friendly and put solar panels on it. And so the question is, if you start looking at limited resources in the world and how much it takes to build solar panels and so forth, what is a better scale to start looking at that problem? Because this individualistic notion that, well, if my house is climate friendly, well, at least I've done my part. That could actually be worse than maybe not doing something for a few years and looking at how can the whole block be climate friendly, how can the whole neighborhood be, and the technology that would address that problem would be very different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say this, you guys, because I think it's important. So we're talking about scale, we're talking about complexity, we're talking about the tendency to polarization, which I think all of us are pretty familiar with. we're talking about the need to be able to take more perspectives, right? And also, you know, what happens when people get discouraged, when these problems are too difficult, when they can't get a response, is what Lisa mentioned. I want to say something on the scale issue, and I'll just open it up right now, and we can talk about it. And Jeff or Terry, if you guys have questions, come on in. But let's just talk about scale for a minute. I had the pleasure a few years ago with Rand Stegen. We were at the YPO conference in Singapore, and there were about 2,500 CEOs at that conference. And this was an integral framework that we presented to them. And we presented, you know, evolving worldviews from ego to ethno to world to cosmic. And there was, you know, these are like, I don't know, they said that 19% of the world's wealth was in the room at that time. And one of the guests at that particular conference was a person named Muhammad Yunus. And I took a keen interest in him because he's the person who developed microlending in Bangladesh and also, you know, has worked on the issue of scale. So I want to talk for just a minute about scale and what you guys think about it, because in my mind, it seems to me that there are certain people in the world that have a genius for scale. And we ought to just take the question directly to them because they know how to deal with scale. What do you guys think?
I would like to offer a kind of amplification of that question on scale, Di, because the diverse areas that we're talking about addressing point to the fact that the tipping point that human civilization is facing requires whole system change. It's a holistic transformation that's ultimately required. Now, clearly, that's a scale that would be so daunting as to be ridiculous. But to some degree, I think every integral activist sees their work in their area of focus as a part of these thousand points of light that are working toward this coherence reestablishing itself in important ways and genuine whole system change happening. And so there's some way that a human being operating at whatever scale is participating in something that ultimately has this vast, you know, integral scale of whole system change altogether that would actually arrive us in a sustainable and a healthy relationship to our whole living planet. And that is a question of scale that, I don't know, for me, brings together everything we're talking about. So I'd love to, you know, that might be something that would help help us all kind of grapple with this question of scale.
Okay, so Terry's views, whole systems and scale. So what are you guys, what are you discovering about working with scale? What can you tell our listeners in terms of their thinking about the problem? So do you have any takeaways or any suggestions related to scale, guys, or what do you think? Julian, what do you think?
Thank you.
Yeah, go Trent.
Well, actually, this is really live for me. Because a lot of what I work with is systems change at the neighborhood, city, energy, like regional energy system level. And a lot of what I'm in opposition to, unfortunately, is well-meaning people doing very small things that are not, they're actually kind of counterproductive in the big scale transformation. And the example is, there's quite a movement on green buildings, which are great. And the difficulty is these people are well-meaning. Like the intention is pure. It's so pure most of the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it comes from a place of individualism where it's actually about agency and that kind of Western individual spirit that people want to be able to point to, I did this, as opposed to it had an impact. And it's really difficult when you're in a conversation with other activists and you're all working on the same things, and it's a really hard thing to navigate that scale one. But my real feeling is that if we don't get there, we are not going to affect the changes that are going to really be required. And to use the saying that Terry just said, I call it 1,000 points of deep green and a rising sea of brown. that's the way the world is feeling to me right now. I see it, well-meaning points of deep green and a rising sea of brown around it, and we've got to figure out how to slow that tide.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we bridge those scales? That's what I'm really grappling.
Okay, well, let's have a, our next big integral conference will be one on addressing the problems of scale complexity and what was the other one? I can't remember, but we'll invite Mohamed Yunus as our keynote speaker. Okay, go ahead. Gail, anybody, Lisa, what do you guys think? Whatever's a lie for you guys, don't let me shape it too much. What would you like from this conversation?
This is Gail here. Something comes up for me in regards to this, and is really a lie for me right now, and that is, you know, what sort of lower left would support the large scale systems change, or sort of the sort of dynamic multi-scaled systems change that we're needing. And I think what kind of lower left we would need, what kind of culture of change agents we would need to make that happen. And it's very intriguing to me. There's a field that's quite new, or a practice, I guess you could call it, called collective impact. And it's really literally people realizing, oh, to get large scale system change happening, we need to have multiple sectors and multiple actors engaged in the process together, which is not normally how activists work. They have sort of a program that they work in and push that forward, versus really people coming from very different kind of agendas and putting their minds together and saying, okay, on the whole, how could this system change? And so collective impact is something kind of a bit of a buzzword. What I've been feeling these days is, you know, a lot of people in the integral community have asked us, what is an integral practice? Just give it to me. Like, give me the 5 points. Give me the cold notes. And it comes up all the time. And I suddenly occurred to me in Guatemala a couple days ago that the reason that's not really answerable within an individual is it's not held within an individual. That there really is this sort of, Ken's called it agency and communion, and that never really landed for me until it landed this week, where it's like, we're not just individuals joining in a group. That's not what's being said. It's actually individuals realizing this, like, shared beingness and operating as that one being. We're not one being, but we're acting as if we are. And it's powerful. And so integral practice or integral activism from that space where there is this collectivity that's moving in and out where appropriate, it becomes a very different moment. And I feel I don't think it's overwhelming for an individual to conceive of large scale systems change. But if you're an individual as operating as collective, it's a very different feeling.
Well,
this is Jeff. That's very exciting. And it feels like it's next. It does feel new and next to me in a way, this collective impact idea. Are you seeing it work? Are people just talking about it, or is there some, we moved into any kind of an implementation of it, or where's it at?
Yeah, definitely.
Movement?
It is what's next, Jeff. I would say it's one of these emerging vision logic type, you know, teal expressions within social change. I know it's working in certain regions and areas, and really interesting multi-stakeholder and multi-perspectival projects. I actually wonder if Lisa or Julianne might have more to say, because it would be part of, I imagine, some of the social innovation certificate that you two teach. And you may have more numbers on that of, like, what's actually working. I do know there's quite a few reports done on how this sort of collective impact manages to push the needle on large scale social or, like, you know, technological systems change. But maybe Lisa or Julianne can say more to that.
Yeah, Lisa, we haven't heard from you for a minute. Julianne,
sure.
Either one.
Oh, Lisa, do you want to go?
Yeah.
I can jump in.
Sure. Yeah, I'll speak. I don't know, you know, specifics so much about collective impact. I know it's being used a lot around poverty reduction in some different programs across Canada. And I think it becomes a method to actually allow people from multi-perspectives to actually get on board around, you know, a similar issue and actually orienting around a particular solution. And I think one of the things, like one of the distinctions, though, that I wanted to bring forward around scaling, and because I think it's helpful in terms of kind of understanding what we're talking about. And this is another colleague of ours, Darcy Riddell, was sort of one of the people that kind of helped to kind of formulate it, this. And it makes the distinction between scaling up, which is moving towards like systems level, policy level change, which is often how we think of scaling. But they also talk about scaling deep, which is around culture change. And so just in kind of response to what you were speaking of Gail, is that it requires really those both ands. So what is that? What are the kind of the policy level changes and the big scale? What do different levels of government need to be engaged in? But actually, how are we changing the culture in terms of how people are relating to climate change, or whether it's, you know, social injustices, and the motivation for policy change will come when there's actually a deeper surge around a culture that supports a different way of thinking about these issues. And there's also scaling out, which is sort of the replication of, you know, innovations in multiple sites. So I think those distinctions are helpful, because I think it what it points to is that the need to actually address consciousness and actually address the lower left when we're actually doing this kind of level, this kind of work, and policies, if they're not also supported by a culture that, you know, has the values and beliefs that are reflective of those policies, can be limited. Depending, there are, you know, for sure there are places where that's not true. But I think that those are all kind of components to thinking about how we actually leverage impact that we're having.
Mm-hmm. And for whatever crazy reason, as I'm listening to you guys, I'm thinking about my experiences of working on these kinds of issues with people, and just how challenging, just because, you know, we're students of integral theory, we're also students of levels of development and, you know, differences in worldview, and we just know how complex it gets when you try to bring lots of different points of view to the table. So, Julian, did you want to add something on that issue of scale?
Yeah, well, just collective impact. Two things I want to say. So collective impact is one of many methods or vehicles, if you want to call it, of how to help different organizations' perspectives collaborate. So there's a wealth of other vehicles out there, and what's most appropriate depends on the problem you're facing. And I think a lot of those are different innovations of how it has been done. But what I want to maybe push the conversation a bit forward, and going back to what Trent said about Michael Stone, and one of the issues is the atrophy of intimacy. And I think we've been speaking and reorientating a lot about collaboration with our fellow human beings and intimacy with ourselves and other fellow human beings. I think the question is really, I think, how can we start expanding our boundaries to what is intimacy with our fellow animated and inanimated beings, our other sentient beings, and how can we be in relationship to nature, to other ways of knowing, and how that is informing our activism and what we're bringing to the world. I know, Dai, you and I talked quite a bit about that, but I think that is really, it's definitely an edge for me. It's like, how am I being informed by not only what's beyond me and my and working with my colleagues and people that have very different perspectives than me, it's also how am I being informed by non-human perspectives.
Yeah, so it might make sense, everybody, to just take a pause for a moment and just notice that as we turn, you know, to the world, and the world is it's a very large scale place, and there's lots of complexity. There's lots of challenges in terms of how people work together, but actually then there's a moment where we turn towards the interiors and we start to breathe into the question Gail raised, which is what kind of culture would it take to be able, what kind of interior culture, what kind of shared values, what kind of view, as Jeff and Terry mentioned, of compassion or of love? You know, what is that relationship on the interior? You know, what kind of durability do we have in relationship, and how do we actually support the transformation that we know often involves tremendous amounts of discomfort? And, you know, as, you know, Julian is posing the question, you know, how is intimacy with all things important to the next phase of our evolution? And for us, I would venture to say, probably all of us on the call, that there's a place in which we can touch into, you know, our deepest, most enduring value. And the way in which our love of the phenomenal world, the nature of all beings, our love of each other, our willingness to endure discomfort in terms, in as the evolutionary process, that's just true for us. And when we have that kind of confidence in one another, what is it that can emerge out of our cultural set that may actually help us at least work on these local and non-local problems? So it is a moment on the call to just kind of take heart and feel yourself in the company of like-minded souls who, whatever is transpiring, our commitment to how we want to be in the world is the same, and that we actually already are in that culture, you know, to answer Gail's question. So I'm going to just take a breath there and see if anybody has anything they want to say in relationship to that shift from looking outward to looking inward.
I'll jump in and just speak a tiny bit to that, because it occurred to me that none of us on the call necessarily or solely identify ourselves as activists. Like, that's, I don't really hear Lisa saying, I'm totally an activist, for example, right? And yet we're all sort of in this space. And mm-hmm. It reminded me of, now I know you guys are all Zen Buddhists and I'm the odd one out a little bit, but I remember in one of Ken Wilber's teachings on the five answers, it doesn't matter if you've not heard it, but in one instance he describes the mirror mind, and he says that you know, you can probably explain this better than me, but, you know, receive each object but doesn't keep it. And then he was describing how the Christian or the Sufi or the Bhakti kind of like reframe of that, or counter to that, or resonance to that is sort of similar to a mirror mind, but every object that arises, you receive and you cherish and you love. Mm-hmm. And it has this sort of emotional tone to how... Yeah, it's really beautiful. And so I've been, over the past few weeks, just contemplating, what is it like to be in the world, not identified as an activist as such, but being that mirror mind,
or
receiving, not keeping.
Even though we practice Zen or we practice meditation, I'm not sure the identity helps us very much, so we can let go of that too.
Right.
Anyway, go ahead, Gail. Keep going.
Yeah, beautiful. That's beautiful. But, you know, but what is that feeling that you yourself feel of, like, receiving each object that's arising and cherishing and loving? And what has it felt on the other side of that? Like, when, how does the fish shop owner, or, like, the 7-Eleven, you know, storekeeper, like, how does it feel when you walk in and you're doing intergalactivism simply by being that mirror mind? Receives, doesn't keep, receives and cherishes. So when you move us into that interior, that's what came up for me. And for me, it's really my practice. It's, we can talk all day about scale and complexity, and that's all true too, but it comes down to that moment of, like, how am I being with this being in front of me, whether it's a plant, a person, a system.
Yeah, beautiful, Gail. Wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's to receive somebody just for who they are, with no aggression, and also not only not necessarily wanting to influence them, but to be influenced by them. You know, what do they actually have to bring, and what do they have to offer me, is just thrilling, you know, as a practice. So I'll vouch for that.
Yeah, Yeah, Jeff, it's interesting that you started us here, and here we are, and it feels really world-creating. You know, in that very moment you're describing, what world arises? And that can be the world that we choose to have arise, you know? And So I'm really grateful you started us there.
Yeah.
I'd like to jump in for a sec here and just also bring, I think, Terry also, what he brought in today is loss of a friend. And I think a lot of the problems that we're facing requires that we work with loss and the pain that comes with it, in the sense none of the parties that I work with are win-win. There's always a party, a stakeholder, a group that loses, and I think that bringing in the interiority, what's the experience of them losing their lands or losing something that they hold dear, and because the collective agrees that the best way forward to adapt, let's say, is to let an area inundate, and that land has been occupied by five generations, and they put their heart and tears and hands mm-hmm. into that land. How do you pace the problem, mm-hmm. the change? So you're holding their pain, and you're at the same time, there is a forceful nature too. That's how we're moving forward. So, as a collective, mm-hmm. I think that question of how we include interiority and how we include the pain and loss mm-hmm. and suffering mm-hmm. that some of these decisions, they're not win-win, mm-hmm. and how we're holding mm-hmm. people's experiences, I think is key to the more compassionate way of moving forward.
Yeah. Aho.
You know, I'm feeling there's a quality of tenderness that comes forward when we include interiority and loss. And it seems to me that the kind of collective impact, you know, collective impact kind of concentrates on the right-hand quadrants and measurable results and things in a very holistic way. But if the interiors are included and this quality of tenderness and connectedness, somehow it becomes integral in a whole different way, especially if there's also mm-hmm. a holding of the inherent perfection of all things. And it's mm-hmm. sort of that spirit that I'm softening into as this conversation comes into its maturity. And it just feels mm-hmm. worthwhile to offer that back, to mirror mind that back to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Terry.
So, yeah, thank you, guys. So you could see in terms of just our, you know, moving around the map of the quadrants and having our focus looking outward towards most particularly climate change, but also some of the other issues, the complex issues that we're all working with. And then how is it that we turn to our own interior to take heart, and also to our culture, and what kind of culture do we want to be a part of? And I love Gail's framing around what kind of world do we want to move into and to commit to that. I know for me, I'm pretty good at working with intense polarity. I spent lots of years as a conflict resolution professional and as a person who could work in a room with people when they're hot and when they're opposed to each other, and be able to somehow support the creativity and the tension of that, and at the same time help people transmute that into something that's workable. But I haven't worked on really complex problems. So polarity feels not that threatening to me, but I feel a little threatened by complexity. Do you guys have any encouraging words to give to me on, as people who are on the call are thinking about the complexity of the stuff they're dealing with?
We should team up.
We should definitely team up. For sure.
Di, I was going to just say, with respect to that, like echoing, I love the way Gail framed that, and sort of intimacy with experience and what's in front of you. But I think there's also like, so there's social activism and right activism, and once you gain that intimacy, it's dealing into in that moment what is the kind of trigger or the point that's going to shift this. So in an interpersonal level, what does it really require in this moment? And I think that only comes, like, God, that is, a tremendous practice. Like, is it a system change? Is it something in lower right? Is it an interpersonal thing? And I'm really, like, interested in that sort of right action aspect of mm-hmm. integral activism and how that comes online and manifests. And
what,
I think that's
what
the
you,
antidote
what you,
complexity.
So the antidote, listen up, everybody, the antidote to complexity is right action. So give us a concrete example of what you mean by that, Trent. You can.
Well, you know, earlier in my activist days when I thought about activism, I think integral activism becomes like just a manifestation in all levels of your life, right? The more it just becomes nuanced, you live it. But there's a tendency to see activism as like fighting for a cause and advocating for a specific outcome, whether it's system change or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're in a meeting, right. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm advocating for a carbon tax. Just raise the carbon tax, do this. And then I'm realizing,
already,
you know, when you really feel into it, yeah, that's there, but that's not what's required in that moment. There was something else that I was missing because I wasn't just truly experiencing what was going on, and what was really going on was a conflict, like, was at a different level than the system change, right? That somebody, like
yes.
Julian said, somebody was losing something, and I had to feel into that, and the right action was different from just advocating for a policy change.
Yeah.
Do you know
beautiful.
What I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
I totally know what you
mm-hmm.
mean. Yeah, Lisa, go ahead. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that Gail? Lisa or Gail, one of you?
That's Gail.
Well,
okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I could, yeah, just thinking about complexity, I just really love how Trent was speaking about that. And I was, when you were saying how polarity is easier for you and complexity is more daunting, yeah, definitely I feel the reverse. I feel like the intensity of a polarity can be almost a bit daunting to me, whereas complexity, I think it's safe to say complexity, when your awareness meets it and doesn't turn away, that complexity kind of grows your awareness. Like there's this beautiful interaction
right.
between awareness
yeah.
and complexity where it's like, I feel like, and you see that when you
beautiful
see children
stuff.
Given complex, yeah, I think we can see it in children. You can see children being presented with more complexity and they will respond by growing to meet it. And I think that just continues
beautiful.
In more refined and interesting ways as adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly,
so my problem might be a bit more like, yeah, go on.
Well, just quickly. So I think that that's
yeah.
also true of polarities. Like being willing to just meet
oh,
the polarity also grows consciousness. Just meet the polarity. Don't freak out. Just meet it in its extremity.
Yeah,
do
yeah.
It see what it's
that's,
about.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Keep going, Gail.
Yeah. That's
keep
really
going.
Great. Thank you. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, wow, I'm learning a lot just being here. We're just winding down. Maybe we should just have one question from our listening audience. Terry, what do you think? And then we're about to wrap up in about 5 minutes.
Terry.
I can't hear. Well, Jeff, do you want to summarize basically what you've
yeah,
what
I mean, actually,
heard
there's
that
one thing
meaning?
I'd add to the part.
Yeah.
There's one. Yeah, I'm not muted, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's one thing I'd add to even the part on the complexity because I get overwhelmed by a lot of it, you know, and even what I'm doing in my own work, and. When I'm at my best, I'm remembering that I'm more here to be faithful than successful, in a sense. That I, if I'm just faithful to the process of putting my next step in front, or my next foot in front of the last foot, and to just keep moving along, making decisions, seeing what arises, you have a whole new perspective, a whole new world when you make a decision. And just sort of relate to that and stay current and stay, you know, where I'm trying to open my heart, get bigger, be ever more effective, have ever more capacity, then the success takes care of itself. And the, you know, the bigger, more complex problem takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. You know, that helps.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very cool. That helps a lot. Sounds like a little...
So I have a slow internet connection here, so I'm having to mute myself via the web, and the unmute didn't happen. But we do have a question from Janet that we might take if we go a few minutes long. Do we want to do that?
You bet. I'd love to hear from Janet.
Oh,
Janet,
hi.
You're on.
Okay. Well, this was more a comment when you were asking. And what I have experienced as the upside of complexity is that no matter what our interests and talents and passions are, there's a role for them by definition. You know, I mean, I'm not an engineer. I'm not in international relations. I'm unlikely to be one of the people figuring out how to help the third world skip over fossil fuels. But there are places where I can work in a problem as wicked as climate change, because there needs to be work everywhere by definition.
Absolutely. 100%.
Beautiful.
And you know, it also, the way in which Gail talked about how we start to see ourselves as individuals, part wholes, we're also individuals within a group, but then there's also a way in which we're one mind, and that to really recognize that, and that each of us fulfilling our particular calling and our particular medicine, if you will, that there's a place for that. And, you know, it helps me realizing that I don't have to know everything, that somebody else can have more understanding of complexity, mm-hmm. and I can rely on them, or someone else can understand scale in a way I don't. And so that it really does kind of introduce us into this notion that we're all in this together, because it's very clear mm-hmm. we have to do it together. So how do we recognize lines of development and levels of development? Like, who actually is it in this moment who's going to take us where we need to go? And in this conversation, we've all traveled together. I mean, it's been very delightful.
I know, and then really
experience.
And a piece, oh, sorry, Dan, I just want to say a piece of that is also being able to really trust another person in your group that you're completely surrendered to, like, how they're going to move this next moment forward. And mm-hmm. that is not common. Like, when we're usually in our roles, in our project management roles or what have you, and we're used to far more control than just, you know, operating as a collective requires that trust and intimacy that we've been circling back upon on this call. Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, really. Wonderful. Maybe just, why don't we just do kind of a one breath from each of our wonderful activists, and then Jeff, Terry and I will say goodbye, and then we'll hand it over to Jeff to close. So, Gail, maybe just a one breath, either summary or goodbye or whatever is in your heart at the moment.
Just gratitude for the opportunity to talk about topics that are obviously really close to my heart, and just gratitude to be here. Thank you.
And Julian, how about you?
Yeah, I would echo that gratitude, and I really enjoyed that conversation. It was fun. I like getting into things and hearing the different perspectives. So I really enjoyed that conversation a lot. And so thank you for hosting this conversation and inviting me into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being here. Lisa, you have a one breath?
Lisa, I can't see her on the line. Somehow her connection broke.
Okay. All right. So just emptiness for Lisa. And Trent, how about you?
Leave it to Lisa to always do the emptiness teaching. love her. Just gratitude. I lots to think about, lots of food for thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for just being in this moment, in this culture. Really wonderful to have you here. Terry, you want to say goodbye? Or one breath?
And I want to invite Lisa to say goodbye because she just reappeared. Hi, Lisa. You're on.
Okay. Hi. Yeah, I'm
I'm managing three kids running in to ask me for. It feels like the real life, like how to be an activist, right? It's like whatever is present in the moment. Like I need tofu and I need this, and so I just feel like what is really present for me is the heart and keeping the heart online and wholeheartedness in this endeavor together is really inspiring, and I just feel grateful to have the opportunity to be with you all in this way.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Thank you. So I just want to say thank you, everybody. I mean, it really does make a difference, you know, when you face the unknown, at least you're facing it with people that you like. So thanks, everybody.
Yeah. That's right. This whole process, whatever it is, witnessed in consciousness and love with action and surrender, well, that's the best I can do.
Yeah.
And I love doing it with all of you.
Yeah, me too. And it's really just indicative of why we do this Integral Living Room. As we say, we have the best conversations of our lives. And I will say that the whole point of getting together like this is that there is a special kind of lower left, a special kind of louche that arises amongst us when people who are integral practitioners or, you know, curious or, you know, lit up by this view, this worldview, that it's a really very, very special thing. So I encourage you to go to the website and look at the past conversations and blog posts and consider joining us in Boulder. We have seats left, and it's, again, November 9th through 12th, and you can see the registration information there. So I think that's good.